This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Before liquor by the drink, before the influx of people from around the country, our dining options here were, and let me say this gently, fairly limited. That is now changing, along with our changing demographics. Today, we can find food options from around the world on area menus, and that says something about us. But what? We're going to look into that this hour. Helen Schwab is a food writer for the Charlotte Observer who's been writing about food within and around Charlotte for over 20 years. She's stuck in traffic and will join us in a moment. Dr. Tom Hanchett is former staff historian with the Levian Museum of the New South, where he continues to be a consultant. He writes on a variety of history topics, including Southern culture and food, and has his own website, historysouth.org. Welcome back.
Glad to be here.
And Bruce Hensley is here. He's president of Hensley Fontana Public Relations Agency. He's handled various marketing duties for over 50 restaurants here since the 1980s and is one of the brains behind Queen's Feast, Charlotte Restaurant Week, which, in case you don't know, is underway, and you didn't bring any food.
No, but Jill is the brains, and I'm the babble and the brawn. She's the brains and the beauty.
Well, I was going to ask Helen this, but you know about restaurants. So I'll ask you, Bruce, in the last several years, since the recession, what new types of foods are available here that were not available then?
Oh, my. All sorts of Middle Eastern and German and sushi everywhere. Chinese, Indian, Pakistani, Yugoslavian. I mean, it's just a whole litany of new concepts that have come to this market.
And what's driving it? Why?
The diversity, the people moving in from all over the country and all over the world to Charlotte, and they're demanding it. And just the folks moving here, you know, we're getting bigger, more cosmopolitan, and we're really inching towards that coveted world-class city benchmark.
It wasn't all that long ago, Tom Hanchett, that I alluded to this in the opening minute, this was a meat and three, meaning a meat, three vegetables, and sweet tea town.
That's right. And banana pudding and macaroni and cheese are
right.
Vegetables.
Yes, and it wasn't that long ago. So what does that say, this new era of food in which all these different kinds of cuisine are suddenly available, maybe in limited quantities, but nonetheless available when they weren't at all available 20 years ago? What does that say about Charlotte?
Well, part of it, I think, is a national obsession with food. The term foodie, nobody had heard 20 years ago. And this is a national, maybe even an international thing. Don't exactly know why that's going on. But Charlotte's becoming wealthier. It's growing. We had 500,000 people in Mecklenburg County in 1990. We've got 1 million now. And there's just a growing market for almost any idea that you want to put out there in front of the public, and restaurateurs are part of that gold rush.
He used the word foodie, and that's kind of a hip, happening word. Does that mean this could be a fad? Do restaurateurs worry about people getting
eventually... 5 years from now, are people going to be eating?
No, I mean, are they going to be looking for this new experience, or will they have experienced it all and just, you know... Whatever, let's go out and have a hamburger.
I contend that it's still a meat and potatoes town. And before the Great Recession, case in point, Charlotte had two Ruth's Chris, two Morton's, a Palm, Sullivan's, Fleming's, Shima, Capital Grill, Del Frisco's, and then we had the local chop houses, the Beef and Bottle and the McIntosh's. So I think there's still the meat and potatoes ilk out there.
Not that there's anything wrong with that.
No.
And those restaurants are wonderful.
Yes,
I mean,
are.
The food, why is that? Why are the steaks in those restaurants so much better than what I can make at home? Why is that?
They're national chains, and they have the buying power, and they put the money behind their staff. I mean, I went to Del Frisco's and Capital Grill during restaurant week, and they were both just outstanding.
Yeah. But why do we have so many? I mean, I know I get that, but is there a difference? If you walked in the door blindfolded at Capital Grill or the Palm or Del Frisco's or Morton's, and the list goes on, would you know where you were?
I would, yes.
Why?
I study them. I didn't get this size by not going to those places. Well, for example, Ruth's Chris has the 1800-degree skillet, so that's their shtick. So you can really smell that well, cooking in the butter when you walk in. And then there's the music at some of the places. The Morton's has the music, and it's a little more dark and cozy. And then you've got the huge bigness of Del Frisco's with an elevator and an escalator and 16,000 square feet. And the same thing with Shima. And you've got, they've got their shtick with the guys in the uniforms, right, and the big swords full of dead animals.
Yeah. How much of it is the experience, the atmosphere, the Disney World nature of it all, and how much of it is actually what's on the plate and how it was prepared?
Well, those places do a great job of both. I mean, they train their staff. Those are professional waiters, which is nice that Charlotte now is finally getting to the ilk where people have these professional waiters that are trained. I mean, I asked our server at Del Frisco's the other night. She said, well, here's the restaurant week menu. And so I said, what's restaurant week? She didn't know who I was. And she had the spiel down beautifully, like she had been trained. Mm. And I was very, very happy to hear that.
Yeah. I had the opportunity to go to Johnson Wales last week as a guest of one of the professors there. And they have courses in front of house in how to be a wait person. And I hadn't realized that. I knew they did the cooking in a most wonderful way at Johnson & Wales, but the fact that they are training people to do what you're talking about, Bruce, that was new to me.
Well, it's a hospitality school. It's not just a cooking school.
That's true.
And I guess that goes with the territory. And I have noticed what you're talking about in places like Ruth's Chris, where the waiters know what they're serving. They know how to tell you. They know how to describe the food. It's accurate. They know how to pair the wine with the dinner, whatever you're getting. They can make suggestions. Also, it seems to be relatively accurate. And they know how to talk to you as a professional and not your best friend down on one knee saying, hey, honey.
Right. They know how to upsell.
Yes, they do. But is there anything wrong with the friendliness of, hey, honey, when the waitress comes over? What's wrong with that?
Works
for me.
It's
kind of Southern. I like that.
Yeah.
You know, a little sassy, knowing the stuff. These new restaurants, these new ethnic restaurants that are coming in that you all talked about, is there a particular demographic that is creating that demand?
Well, Charlotte's becoming an international city, and that's something that's also new as we're growing in population. 1990, this area had maybe 1% foreign-born, and now we're up around 12-15%, something like that. And over the weekend, I was at the Puerto Rican Festival, and there were thousands and thousands of people at that festival in a town that we don't think there is much of a Puerto Rican population here. And the answer is that there are a lot of people coming from every corner of the world.
So when a new Thai restaurant opens up, when a new Ethiopian restaurant opens up, and there are several in Charlotte, are these being opened, I take it, by people from those parts of the world? Are they opening them because there's a significant population of folks like themselves who want to eat their home cuisine, or are they opening them because they see that Charlotte at large wants to eat this cuisine? Because most people have never tried.
With some of the cuisines, the more name brand ones, there are people who are marketing to the general population, particularly young hip folks. One of my favorite places is Futabudo Ramen, which is just so much fun to say, and it's on the light rail in South End. And folks who are not Asian running it, and folks who are not Asian eating there, as well as Asian people, I'm sure. But on the other hand, out on Monroe Road, there's a new restaurant called Island Hub, and it's folks from Haiti. And they actually are from Haiti via New York City. And when I talk to them about who's there, there's a variety of people, a lot of people of Haitian background, a few people like me who are curious about food. But the person who was the owner said, we get a lot of people from New York, a lot of people from Philadelphia, a lot of people from Detroit, where Caribbean food in general is part of the regional cuisine. And they miss it, and so they come to our restaurant, homesick for New York, as a Haitian restaurant. It makes perfect sense.
In a recent article that you wrote, you said that you pointed out that, Tom, unlike other cities where you find foods from elsewhere clustered in places like Chinatowns or little Italian enclaves in places,
right.
We don't have that. Our ethnic restaurants are scattered throughout the city. Is that because we are just now getting this influx of people from other parts of the world, and they are not being segregated into, I don't mean this pejoratively, into ghettos, but that's what Chinatowns were,
right,
and are.
Right.
Is that because they just settle anywhere and they plunk their restaurant down where they can find a space?
I do think that's what's going on. I've written a couple of essays calling this salad bowl suburbs. Not that everybody eats salad there, but it's mingled like a salad. Where you have the lettuce and the tomatoes and the onions and all of that and the anchovies all creating a new dish. And Central Avenue is like that.
Mm-hmm.
You can park once and Central and Rosehaven and eat Salvadoran food, eat Mexican food, go to a Vietnamese restaurant, go to a Middle Eastern restaurant, go to a Somali restaurant. This is not just Central Avenue. South Boulevard's like that. Polk Street and Pineville out in the burbs is like that. Even if you go out to the Levine campus of CPCC, go down Potter Road, and you can find that kind of mixing. So I think we don't have the older Chinatowns or Little Italies that were created in the era of intense segregation 100 years ago in big cities. We're creating something new. When I go to other cities, I'm finding this as well. If you go out into the older suburbs built in the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s. In fact, I did a piece with the New York Times with John T. Edge of Southern Foodways Alliance. We went to Indianapolis, where we had not been, and we found exactly that same kind of mixing. So it's if you're looking for Chinatown, you think, well, Charlotte just doesn't have any Asian culture. But if you look in the right place, you can find some pretty darn good Korean restaurants and Thai restaurants and Japanese restaurants, and some of them for and by non-Japanese, and some of them very much by the people for them.
So the fact that these restaurants are not clustered in one geographic era, all the Chinese restaurants here, all the Italian restaurants there, all the German restaurants over here, does that allow them to expose themselves more quickly to more people, thereby increasing demand, because people will be walking down the street and there's a line outside the door at the place we plan to go to. Let's try this new other place that I've never had the food from. Is it helping spread the word?
I don't know whether it's helping. I would love to ask that question out there in the real world. It certainly is helping people like me who are curious about eating, curious about who our neighbors are. And I love getting off of the interstate and getting on South Boulevard. It's not any slower if you've been on I-77 going south recently. Doggone, there's a new Greek bakery called Moco Bistro over there. I got to get to that place.
Yeah. You meant when you did the list of Asian restaurants a second ago, you left out a category, Chinese. And I remember when I first moved here, there were a couple of Italian restaurants, there were Greek restaurants, there were the meat and threes, and there was a couple of Chinese restaurants. Chinese restaurants have just kind of disappeared off the landscape. What's going on with Chinese food?
Remember the Moon Garden from 1970s?
Yeah, yes.
The Hotoy over in Plaza Midwood?
Restaurant Tokyo? That's Japanese.
But no. We called it Scrantonese.
But what happened?
I don't know.
Because it's Thai has taken over the world now. Thai restaurant, Asian fusion restaurants, Korean restaurants are now beginning to crop up, and you'll see Korean menu items on non-Asian restaurants. I went to a barbecue place the other day. They had Korean barbecue.
Alrighty.
Yeah. We have to take a break. We'll come back and talk more about food and the food culture in Charlotte, how it's changing, and what it says about us in a moment. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Live Nation, presenting Nick Offerman and Megan Mullally of 69 No Apostrophe Tour, August 11th at Ovens Auditorium. Tickets available at livenation.com. Well, the impact of HB2 is now being felt. Last week, the NBA announced they were pulling their All-Star weekend from Charlotte. City businesses are now set to lose an estimated $100 million. But there's also been an impact on the city and the state's image and on LGBTQ individuals who have lost protections against discrimination. So tonight at 7 o'clock, WFAE is hosting a public conversation on the impact of all this on our economy and our image, both here and around the state. That's at the McGlowan Theater tonight. You can get more information about it at WFAE.org. It will be a live broadcast tonight, and it will be repeated tomorrow morning on this program at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, opening night at the Democratic Convention in Philadelphia, how speakers, including Senator Bernie Sanders, Senator Elizabeth Warren, and First Lady Michelle Obama, seek to bridge party divides and build the case for presumptive nominee Hillary Clinton.
The Diane Rehm Show, following Charlotte Talks from 10 to noon on 90.7 WFAE, listener-funded public radio.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the changing food scene in Charlotte with Dr. Tom Hanchett, historian and consultant with the Levine Museum of the New South, from which he retired not too long ago, but he's still working like a madman. Bruce Hensley, president of Hensley Fontana PR and one of the people behind Restaurant Week, which is underway. Charlotte used to be devoid of lots of restaurants, and that's because there's not really a Southern tradition of eating out. Is there, Tom?
This amazed me when I came to Charlotte. I came in the 1980s, and that was when there were the two Chinese restaurants.
Right.
I had people tell me, oh, you're from Chicago, which is where I'd gone to school, and Charlotte's a big city now. We've got two Chinese restaurants. I lost my train of thought.
I was going to say, we didn't have a tradition of eating.
Oh, yes. Talked to Arthur Dye, who grew up here. And grew up on Elizabeth Avenue and was talking about restaurants. And where did you go out to eat? He said, we didn't. There just was not a going out to eat thing. It was a poor region. And if you wanted a celebratory meal, you went to grandma's on Sunday afternoon and she went out in the yard and killed a chicken. And I'm not making a joke. That was the meat for the week often. The other days you might have beans and onions or cornbread or something like that. So there just wasn't a lot of money floating around for that. I can remember that when I came here, people still recalled the S&W cafeteria. And cafeterias today are a little bit low rent. The S&W cafeteria was two doors off the square. Art Deco, wonderful place. You dressed up to go there. So that was Charlotte's big deal until Greek folk showed up and started opening really our first restaurant.
This may sound like a ridiculous question, but what kind of a role did fast food play in changing eating habits, in getting people to put money down for a meal they didn't cook themselves?
I think it was revolutionary. It certainly was in my family. I grew up, I was born in 1956, and so when I can remember when fast food restaurants hit our part of the South. I was growing up in Roanoke, Virginia at that point. And we had not gone out to dinner except on Sundays. And now you could go to the Carroll's restaurant and get hot French fries with your dad, who didn't tell your mom that they were going there. And it was just wonderful. And so it was a small amount of money. And it got people into the habit, I think, of substituting a restaurant-cooked meal at a reasonable price for a home-cooked meal.
Of course, the value of money has changed, but I remember when French fries at McDonald's were 12 cents, Cokes were 10, and hamburgers were 15. Now, that's a pretty inexpensive meal, right. But I don't know what that value of that money was back then. But that we went there for special treats because we didn't have any money when I was growing up, and that's where we went. That or what we called the Hot Shop, which was a Marriott restaurant in the D.C. suburbs. That was a big treat. That was a big deal going there.
And the people who figured that out are today very well-to-do. Jerry Richardson,
yeah.
the Panthers
Hardys.
Guy. Had been playing for the NFL, got a bonus, came home to Spartanburg, South Carolina, talked with a friend, and put it into this notion of these Hardee's restaurants. and became extremely wealthy, extremely influential as a food person, and then brought the Panthers here.
And the first Hardee's was on Eastway, right where the U.S. food store is, and that was the old witch's hat. The roof looked like a witch's hat. And the first McDonald's was on Independence Boulevard, just east of Ovens Auditorium.
Ah, liquor by the drink. That changed the landscape. And I know that your father, Bruce, was involved in the campaigns, and there were several, to get liquor by the drink passed and become a reality. How big a role has this played in the numbers of restaurants that we have today? Would they be here today, even with the growth of population, were it not for?
No way. Without a doubt, the most significant date for Charlotte restaurant industry is September the 8th, 1978, when Mecklenburg County voters passed the mixed drink referendum, allowing restaurants to sell and serve liquor drinks. So for the uneducated out there, until then, diners who wanted mixed drinks had to bring their own spirits concealed in a brown bag to a permitted restaurant, turn over the bottles of liquor to the restaurant, and then they would charge the customers for the setups of ice and whatever mixer was used. And this ridiculous and despised ritual was known as brown bagging. And the customers would actually have to pour their own drinks under the table. To add insult and often jail time to the dining experience, it was illegal to transport open bottles of liquor in the vehicle, giving the guest great incentive to finish the bottle of liquor at dinner before driving home.
Because you couldn't take it home.
Right.
If you got pulled over, you'd be...
Right. It was illegal.
Helen Schwab is here. Where did you come from?
My apologies.
That's
Mike.
Okay. We'll buy you a watch.
So Charlotte, being the buckle of the Bible Belt, was thrust into the national media spotlight when preachers throughout the region vehemently opposed the Mecklenburg County mixed
drink. So this came up for a vote, not once, but I think two or three.
Three times.
The forces working against the passage of this were fundamentally, what, religious forces, or were there political forces as well?
Both.
So what were they saying would happen if liquor by the drink passed?
Bars,
bars,
topless joints.
Everything would happen.
Henderson Belk was against it, one of the Belk brothers. Mm-hmm. He was hugely against
Have the things they said
Privet.
Would happen come to pass?
No.
No?
No. The tax base and the restaurants started coming in. And, you know, the first one that really came in was Longhorn Steaks was the first one of the first national chains to actually come in. And they weren't even really a chain then. The second one in the whole system was right here in Charlotte.
Why is it so important that restaurants be able to sell liquor, not just beer and wine, but liquor? Why is that so important?
It's how you make money.
And part of
the experience. You make a whole lot more money on alcohol than you do on food. A whole lot more.
Because of the markup. But you make it on wine, too.
You do.
And some of these restaurants before Liquor by the Drink, if I'm not mistaken, they could serve wine. Is
and
that
beer.
Correct?
Correct.
And beer. So, you know, you buy a glass of wine, and it's usually the price of the bottle.
Right.
That'd be 400 times or 600 times markup, depending on the ounce. But, yeah, I mean, a lot more.
Yeah.
True.
So why isn't that the same for a Manhattan? Versus a glass of wine.
But you've got people who don't want to drink that. You've got people who don't... I mean, the cocktail drinkers and the wine drinkers are not necessarily the same audience at all. I mean, look at any cocktail menu in town now. The sugar content is off the charts. Those are not your wine drinkers. Those are people who want to drink alcohol without feeling like they've actually drunk any alcohol.
I should reintroduce you because you weren't here for a little while because of traffic. So that's okay. Helen Schwab, food writer for the Charlotte Observer. She's been on the show many times before, and she's been writing about food in this area for a while, shall we say, to be polite.
How diplomatic of you.
So your father was one of the people, Bruce, who helped organize that campaign and finally got it passed somehow with Liquor by the Drink. Meanwhile, you and your wife are responsible for this Queen's Feast Restaurant Week that happens, what, two times a year now?
Yes, July and late January.
But you are not. Neither of you are in the, and neither was your father, in the restaurant business.
No, I have been an investor in three restaurants in town. I'm not currently, but through the public relations activity that we've done for about 60 restaurants.
For those who may not know, the concept behind Restaurant Week is what?
It's a gastronomic delight. It is
spoken like a true public relations man.
Restaurant Week, it's actually a national phenomenon now. We twice a year we have about 135 restaurants that pool their resources together, i.e. funds, to promote three-course dinners for just $30 or $35 over a 10-day period, late July and late January. And what the restaurants get out of this is they get business during a slow time. They cash flow during what is typically a slow period. They get to keep their staff working, and they get the coveted trial business because the general consumer is getting out of their typical economic or geographic footprint and going to new places.
So this, for those people who don't know, there's the standard menu, and then there's the special Queen's Feast menu.
Correct.
Where you're essentially sampling what, the chef or the owner believe are entrees and desserts and appetizers that will make you want to come back again.
Exactly. It gives the restaurant an opportunity to put their best foot forward. And the margins aren't good, so it's about marketing. It's not about making money, and the restaurants understand that. We are told by restaurateurs that on average they see 75% new faces during Charlotte Restaurant.
Do they come back?
I believe that.
Absolutely.
They come back?
The best compliment I ever got was from Jessica Annunziata at Passion 8 in January of 2015. We were doing a UNC TV television show for the weekend, and she comes up to me and she said, "Bruce, my restaurant is 100% full, and I recognize no one." That's the best compliment I could ever have.
Wow.
So just to, for balance there, I think that is true for many places. I think the reality is that some places, and we're not calling out people, do things because they know that Restaurant Week crowd is a crowd that is not likely to come back, much of them. Some of them do, absolutely, and some places win that business with absolutely stellar performances. That is not always the case, which is not in Bruce's bailiwick to control. And wait staff will tell you completely unsolicited. We were at a restaurant for Restaurant Week during Restaurant Week, and I said, actually, we'd like to see the regular menu. And she went, "Oh, normal people." So I think there is an element of the audience that uses Restaurant Week smartly, efficiently, to get into places that they would not normally go.
No question.
The best part of that audience says, "Wow, Del Frisco's, I would never have maybe thought I could afford it, and this was amazing, and I want to go back." I think a chunk of that audience says, "I've got $30. Don't try to upsell me." Very suspicious, very, and understandably so, because I think they're getting out of, their normal, as you say, their normal venues, and will not be back ever. Because they see it as a Groupon, basically, and they're thinking, "I'm going to get this deal and leave." And I think that kind of thing can color your experience. And so what I tell people always is, be mindful that it is likely to be crowded. Be mindful that it is likely maybe to slow down. This is not necessarily the restaurant at its most perfect. But think about it. Give it some room. Give it some leeway. And if you like it, please go back.
I wasn't going to talk about this, but you just brought up Groupon. Do Groupons and couponing in general, because you sometimes get these leaflets in the mail or even on the back of your Harris Teeter receipt, there'll be a Groupon for a coupon for a restaurant. Do they work in the restaurant's favor, or do they just bring you in the door for that one meal, and if you don't get another coupon, you aren't coming back?
Totally depends on who you're talking about. I think there are absolutely people in both those camps. I think because Groupon takes such a chunk of the money, what I have heard from restaurant people is, "Boy, I probably don't want to do that again." Because not only did I sell my meal for half to the consumer, I'm also giving half of that to Groupon. So it's really a loss.
I didn't know that.
That's where the alcohol sales come in, because that's what they're hoping to make their margins. So, and to Helen's point, she's exactly right. But a lot of these one-timers will use Restaurant Week to look for special occasion places for the birthday and the anniversary. Then they'll go back to the Del Frisco's.
Yeah.
So they're shopping around to see what they like to do on that special day.
Right.
Okay.
Or girls' night out. We see a ton of girls' night out during Restaurant
Week. And I think some of the restaurants also, again, to be fair, I think some restaurants try to do their signature dishes and try to do some really wow stuff. I think some restaurants do the thing that will cost them the least to get on the table in front of people and get out.
And the dining public knows that.
And some of the dining public knows that. I think not everybody. So I think that is something to, if you study your menus, if you're really looking for the deal, you got to do the work.
Yep.
You got to look at the menu, how much of it is available. It says steak. What's the weight of that steak? Is that their regular steak? Because probably not. So check those things out and do your homework, and you can get some great deals. But they're not all great deals.
Okay. We were talking about this before you arrived, Helen, and the changing possibilities.
I was listening.
I'm glad. The changing nature of Charlotte food and what's available here and the wider variety that's available here than was available here 10 or 15 or 20 years ago. So when did you first start noticing that change taking place?
It's probably the first time I had Italian food in a restaurant that had Italian people in it as opposed to Greek people, which
was... Is that Mangione's on East Boulevard?
That Mangione's might have been, and yeah. Anna Mangione was...
She was awesome.
Now, right?
Awesome.
Charlotte, for people who don't know, Charlotte's Italian restaurant scene was run by Greek restaurateurs. So you would get your spaghetti with baklava for dessert, and it was amazing. And the open kitchen remains. I just had chicken livers from the open kitchen because Kathy Purvis brought them kindly to me. So I loved those restaurants dearly. But to have an Italian restaurant serving, and then it was regional Italian, which was thrilling beyond belief. And I think C might have been the first regional Tuscan, you know, professedly Tuscan place, which was, very exciting.
Right.
You mentioned Chinese. I can't figure it out, and neither can the people who write to me. We've had a series of brilliant places that have left. Ho Toi is on my list of top 10 restaurants I wish were still here, with Chez Daniel and a couple others. Ho Toi was brilliant. And there's a range of reasons that happens.
Oh, by the way, you were looking for a real Chinese restaurant, and Lee Cafe in Fort Mill, real near the Carowinds Fireworks places. The woman who runs it is from Beijing, and she brought in Chinese chefs, and they have three different chefs, including one that specializes in vegetarian stuff. It is next to a Food Lion, like most of our Chinese restaurants in the South, but it's the real deal. Lee Cafe.
There is also a Vietnamese restaurant, I think it's still there, in Rock Hill, on I think Main Street in Rock Hill, run by a Vietnamese woman who's put three kids through Harvard University, and she has...
I think she's got one at Harvard
cuisine.
And one who went to Stanford and one who went somewhere else.
Yeah.
It's a great story.
Boy. It's a terrific and good food. I mean, really good food. And I hope she's still open down there. We talked a little bit about this wide variety of food, like Ethiopian food coming to town. And you've written about that. And until recently, South American foods were not readily available or easily available here. When you go to these places as a food writer, and these are... I would assume a lot of these are new cuisines for you. You've probably maybe never eaten certain dishes. How do you write about them? How do you know what to say? How do you know that what you're eating is actually good or, in fact, representative of the food you would get if you were in that country?
So let me congratulate you for saying representative instead of authentic, which is the word I would ban from the language when we're talking about restaurants. And I always tell the story of writing about pozole in a Mexican place and describing it and having someone call, two people call me on the same day, one to say, that's not authentic, there wasn't hominy in it, and the next person to say, we would never put hominy in pozole, that's crazy. Both authentic, both people who grew up in Mexico with mom cooking this soup, both completely not agreeing.
Right.
So for me, you either try to find someone who does know, or you do a lot of research and you make a lot of calls. So it is, you know, I would like to say I've been to every country in the world and can authoritatively weigh in on cuisines, but I can't.
Right.
It's like the James Beard Awards. I don't know what the best restaurant is in America because I haven't been to them all. So I have a little, you know, I think you go into it with your eyes open and you try to do the best that you can at sharing things. I think Tom Hanchett is someone who is brilliant.
We have to take a break. We'll come back and talk more about Charlotte's food options, how they're changing, a little bit more about Restaurant Week, because it's everywhere. It's not just Charlotte. It's all over the darn place. And we'll find out how that happened, too. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the Harvey B. Gantt Center, presenting Feast on Culture Thursday. Chef Ted Fellow and culinary historian Michael W. Twitty use food to ignite conversation. Details at GantCenter.org. Last night was opening night of the Democratic National Convention in Philadelphia. House speakers, including Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, and First Lady Michelle Obama, seek to bridge party divides and build the case for presumptive nominee Hillary Clinton will be the topic of the conversation in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock on The Diane Rehm Show. If you'd like to join our conversation about food in Charlotte, how it's changing, what it says about us, now's your shot. You can email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org or search for WFAE on Facebook or get to us through Twitter at Charlotte Talks, and we're coming right back.
This afternoon, let's go somewhere.
We begin the program in Paris, which is...
And then over in East Africa, you have
a series of raids throughout Brussels and other cities.
The first Saudi women to vote, celebrated with hugs and...
As airports go, Concord Regional is still young at 21 years old. The city of Concord built it to...
All Things Considered takes you around the world and back in minutes. Listen, every afternoon.
All Things Considered, weekday afternoons beginning at 4 on WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins, talking about Charlotte's changing food scene this morning with Helen Schwab, who's joined us now from the Charlotte Observer, directly from the pages of the Charlotte Observer. Dr. Tom Hanchett is here as well, historian and consultant with the Levine Museum of the New South, and Bruce Hensley is the president of Hensley Fontana PR. They're the people behind Restaurant Week or Queen's Feast. When we've talked in the past about the history of food and how we've kind of developed from a no-restaurant culture to a lot of different kinds of restaurant culture. The name that sticks out as one of the people who are really in the early days of making a dent in this and setting a stage for this is Slug Claiborne. Put him into perspective.
Classic. And that's all kinds of history when you start talking about Slug and what he did. Not only dining history, from cafeterias to fine steak at the top of the, what building was it?
First Union.
Right. Yeah. Now Wachovia,
okay.
Too.
He first came on the scene running a cafeteria on Independence Boulevard at a time when cafeterias were much more chic than they are now. Mm-hmm. And his brother, Jack Claiborne, was a reporter for the Charlotte Observer who covered business but also was really interested in civil rights. And Slug was the guy in 1963 who said, I want to desegregate. I know many other restaurateurs do, but unless we do it together, it's not going to work. And so he worked with Stan Brookshire, Brookshire Freeway,
right.
The mayor. And they worked out a deal in May of 1963 where the Chamber of Commerce, all white guys, called African-American friends. They went two by two and desegregated the upscale restaurants, the cafeterias, the movie theaters. A year before the 1964 Civil Rights Act. So
that could have ruined him.
It could have if it wasn't done well. And instead, I think it's a real turning point in Charlotte's history. So there's a place where food made a much bigger difference than just eating there. But he had this whole series of restaurants, which flummoxed me as a newcomer in 1981.
Named Slug.
Slugs. And Slugs, and there was Rib, one. There was one in Chapel Hill, even called Slugs at the Pines.
And Choice.
Why would you want to go there?
What's their signature dish?
He had 15 restaurants at his peak, and I think he did more for fine dining in Charlotte and North Carolina than anybody. He had restaurants in Winston-Salem, Asheville, Wilmington.
It's very accessible.
And he was here at a time when we were. When there weren't that many dining options, and he's kind of set the stage or set the table for those options to come along. Today, we have a lot of restaurants, it seems, but do we have enough? Are we underserved? It seems to me that particularly in Southend, where the idea, the hope is that all these apartment dwellers will use the light rail and not drive their cars, and they will have on their first floor of all these apartment buildings retail and dining opportunities. That hasn't materialized. I don't see a lot more dining opportunities in that part of the world than what there already were. Am I imagining that? Is that a misperception?
Yeah, I think a little bit. I mean, there's a lot that's boomed in Southend. I don't know to what degree it is from the apartment dwellers, but I will tell you, for example, when Soul Food Meat Company opened a quasi-Korean place, you could literally, the wait was 2 hours for the first week. And I thought, I am not standing here for 2 hours. I can't drink enough beer to stand here for 2 hours. So I'll be back later. And that was a very, I would say, millennial crowd. So between the breweries, that have just completely covered that area, and little places from Fudo Buddha, I know Bruce mentioned that, to the little Krispy Crepe, to Soul Food, to
Chop Shop is part of that energy, and they keep expanding. I think they're expanding, or somebody's going in next to them right now on South Boulevard. And you don't think of that if you're driving in your car as being part of the light rail corridor, but it's a block off the light rail.
Mm-hmm.
And if people will stop using Uber and get more on the light rail, which is something that I think is also happening, that people use Uber rather than the light rail because Uber came up about the same time. So there is that quality of if you're going out, it's very easy. I think we thought light rail and they're trapped and they'll have to eat here. It'll be great. So I think there's a mix. There are more options. I think the question then becomes, who are you trying to serve? Are you trying to – is your demographic, is your target audience 25-year-olds with money? And that will lead to long cocktail lists and breweries and beer food and what are you looking for? So when you say, is our community underserved, I would say, yes, it's woefully underserved, but not in that category.
And I said Chop Shop, I meant Max Speed Shop.
I'm
going to come back and ask you that.
The development that's going where the Pepsi plant is in South End, and apparently is going to have several restaurants on the ground floor.
Mm-hmm.
And Waverly, out south of 485, is going to have quite a few restaurants.
And how many are not chain already? Do you know?
I mean,
have you heard anything about?
I do not.
What would you say the ratio of chain restaurants to Ma and Pa, or at least local chains? Like Frank Schiavelli owns a bunch of different restaurants,
right?
Some of which are chains that he's trying to establish. But how many would you say are restaurants like that, or Ma and Pa shops, versus the chains?
Yeah, that's a great question. I did it a few years ago, and I haven't done it. Bruce is pulling out a piece of paper here, so maybe he can answer that.
I was just
that.
Looking at the Restaurant Week list. I think it's probably about even. I mean,
probably on this list, because I think more mom and pop would be more interested in doing this. When you're talking, like I was at Babalu last night, which is a chain, brand new, just opened yesterday.
Owned by Desi Arnaz.
That is the joke, in case you don't know. It was named for Desi Arnaz's song.
Yeah,
that's
Babalu.
Why it was named. But that's corporate, and so it's, I think we're getting a whole lot more of that right now. There's probably 10 or 11 getting ready to open that are corporate from Oku and Charleston, chain-ish.
You, before you got here, Bruce called this a meat and potatoes town. Would you agree with that?
We're trying so hard not to be. We're trying so hard. And I actually tried to do a search for how many times have I written that Charlotte is on the verge of becoming a good dining city. And it's been a whole lot of times. 2012, 2013, 2014, 2015. We got a hiccup here that we're not addressing. We're just not getting there. And I think there are
Why?
A couple people that are. It, to me, it is about the audience. It is not about the talent. I think we've got the talent. And I think I've had this discussion with Kathleen Purvis, who is the food editor at The Observer. Is it that people won't buy? Are people not interested in what these chefs are capable of doing that would be along the lines of other cities? And I tend to think it's that. She feels as though people are more willing to order things. I feel like not fast enough.
So it's because they're the chefs, chef-driven restaurants are fixing foods or using recipes that we don't recognize, and I'm not going to spend $37.50 for something I might not like.
I think that is a legitimate and legitimate prevalent place where diners are. And I think it's more like not just $37, I'm not spending $15 on something that I don't know. And I don't blame people for that. It's not that.
How do we get over that hump? How do you get over that? Atlanta got over the hump, right?
To a degree. I mean, Charleston is a tourism city. So that is not, you are not serving the same crowd all the time. You are serving travelers. That is a very different dining audience than hometown. And I'm not casting aspersions on hometown. Any place that is serving a lot of travelers as a huge portion or percentage mm-hmm. of its business is going to be almost by definition more progressive in its cuisine.
You worked, Bruce, in your lifetime with a restaurant called Ocean Air, which was
yes.
a seafood restaurant here for a while. And you learned in that period of your life, you say, that Charlatans don't think twice about paying $35 for a piece of steak, but they're hard-pressed to consider that price for a beautiful, these are your words, a beautiful and healthier piece of fish that was swimming off the coast of Hawaii yesterday. Now, they closed that restaurant in 2009. Is that still the case today, do you think?
I think so, unfortunately.
Why? Why is steak? Because it's comfort food.
We
know what it is. It's like going to McDonald's. You know what you're going to get.
Because they're not used to having fish that fresh that was literally swimming off the coast of Hawaii yesterday. That's something new for Charlotte.
And you better cook it till it's not juicy anymore. is a thing, and that is not everybody, but there is concern about that. And I think
you're talking about fish now.
Yes.
Yes. I agree with them. Those people, by the way.
I know you do. We've had this discussion.
And
let's not have it.
I get these nasty looks by waiters.
Mm-hmm.
I just don't want it to be.
Mm. I totally do not understand, Mike. But I love you anyway.
I see.
It is a question. I had a restaurateur who told me off the record that when he opened his place, he had and this could the people this could be are legion. So I will be giving away nothing. Really, an inventive menu planned. Uh-huh. And so I always tell people go right away when restaurants open if you want to see what their idea is, because it is possible, if not likely, that will shift as the customer base makes known what it wants. And that's, again, it is what it is.
That must be horribly depressing for the people opening these restaurants, because particularly chef-driven restaurants, because they go in with all these creative ideas and they know that what they're doing is good. They're educated enough to know that what they're doing is they're doing it right. They're doing it well. It's great. And nobody gets it.
And I think some people do, probably just enough to make it harder, because they will get good reaction from people
right.
when they're doing a pigtail that people are really excited about. So they'll do it enough. And again, I think that's how you get there. I mean, it's a slow path. And I think the best of our great chefs will bring people along, and they'll earn their trust. And that is a full service. You've got to have the service. You've got to have your servers who really know. You've got to welcome them and be warm. It's part of the reason Kindred has done well.
Let me share with you some comments that have come in while we've been talking from listeners. Aaron on Facebook, where do food trucks fit into our food culture?
I'm over in Plaza Midwood at the Light Factory Gallery on Central Avenue on Fridays. My office is there now. And it is amazing, the range of food trucks. They're becoming new incubators for new ideas. And people are lining up to try, Moroccan food sold by a little Moroccan guy from Rock Hill. It just amazes me. So I think that is one source of change, Helen, we are already seeing where brick-and-mortar restaurants are growing out of that.
And you've seen, yeah, like Aaron with Tapas 51, who was doing a food truck first, and if I'm remembering right. And there have been some people. I mean, way back in the day, that's how Cassie Parsons started when she did Harvest Moon. She wanted to do a food truck first with the Grateful Growers Pork. So there is a history of people being able to do, and if you saw Chef, was it called, the movie, where he decides he's going to leave his restaurant and start a food truck and do whatever he wants. There is that opportunity. It can be hard. It can be challenging to find your audience. But it's a way for people who don't then need the brick and mortar.
Kevin emails Cuisine. I live in Plaza Midwood, and our choices are pizza and burgers. Every time a new restaurant opens, it's usually a pizza and beer parlor. I'm from Savannah, where food is an art. Charlotte, not even close. There is no diversity in restaurants in Charlotte.
You need to go to Bistro Le Bon, and that's the best restaurant in that
There is no diversity, and the fellow lives in Plaza Midwood.
Are you kidding?
You got to go a little bit further out Central Avenue, my friend, and go to you can eat your way around the world on
yes.
Central Avenue. And then if you turn right on Albemarle Road, one of the best
Asia,
Syrian bakeries you've ever won.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that's true too, Golden Bakery. So you really do get, I mean, he we love you, sir, but you do need to get out more. And we can help you with that. Tom's HistorySouth.org.
HistorySouth.org. It's the food from home columns that I've written for the Charlotte Observer, and they're on a map so you can figure out where they are in space.
And then we at the Observer, just for him, let me say, there is a, if you Google Tour the World International Food in Charlotte, we did videos of restaurant owners in various from various countries talking about their signature dish. So if you're worried about it and you want to see it before you go and you want to have someone describe it, go to that. It'll help.
And speaking of maps, because this is radio, Bruce brought an enormous map on which
–
put it up to the microphone so we can all see it. So people can see where Restaurant Week restaurants are located, and they're all over the place, from Hickory to Rock Hill and everywhere in between. What's the percentage of restaurants that we have available to us that are participating in Restaurant Week? Is it like 20%, 50%? What is it?
We vet and invite about 250, and we have 134 participants.
So how many restaurants do we have here?
But we have like 1,200.
Yeah.
I mean,
fast food and mom
I don't
and
even
pop.
Know.
And are the restaurants that are participating, are they in various different categories? So that if you say there's no variety of food, would you be wrong? Would you be pleasantly surprised by discovering that we do have variety by going to restaurant?
Oh, food? Tremendous. Variety.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Just checking.
Tremendous.
Lisa emails. You can put the map down now because I think people have gotten a pretty good idea from... I'm looking at the radio. Lisa emails as vegans. We have almost no choices here in the South. We look forward to our trips elsewhere where we can find creative vegan food. But here we cook at home where I can make better, more interesting dishes than the sad portobello sandwich.
So Luna's Living Kitchen, Fern,
South
Woodlands,
Boulevard.
For Indian. I mean, I think we've got a handful, but I can't call her wrong because we have not bridged... I have a younger daughter who for a while was vegan and gluten-free.
Oh, gosh.
But seriously, check out international restaurants because the non-meat options are much more prevalent
in
many Asian cuisines.
Particular Asian, yep.
David emails very quickly, a four-person family eating lunch at any of these new arrival restaurants will cost us between $75 and $100 if there are any drinks beyond water or soda. $80 recently at, I won't mention the restaurant, but they love the food. We have to save for a few months to go back. A fun adventure for our reasonably affluent family, but who can pay those prices consistently? Not us. What about prices? What's the average price?
I don't have statistics. I would say places that I go, entrees that are finer dining between $15 and $35. Do ethnic places, little ethnic places. Crispy Banh Mi just opened. Take your family of four, get out of there for $30.
Okay, so go be more selective because restaurants have a tough time making it as it is. We have to stop. We're out of time. Helen Schwab from the Charlotte Observer, Tom Hanchett from HistorySouth.org, Bruce Hensley.